We're very happy to have Brother Carl Hagensack with us from the Chicago Ecclesia. And his subject today is In Defense of Esau. Brother Carl.
Well, brethren, we too are very glad that we can be with you. It's been a few years since we've had the privilege of being in the Los Angeles Ecclesia, and we enjoy the opportunity of being here, however briefly. We have enjoyed the past 2 days being with so many of your young people up at Lake Arrowhead, and they voted this morning that as we came here this afternoon, we convey the love of the little group from there. We also bring the love and greetings from the Chicago Ecclesia, and particularly from my wife, Sister Marge. Esau is one of those characters that we don't talk about too much. You know, the Bible is full of heroes. You've got your Abrahams and your Davids and your Noahs. These are the ones that are listed by Paul in Hebrews 11. And these are the ones that form the beautiful examples of faith for each of us. The Bible is also full of villains. You've got your Jezebels and your Ahabs. You've got your Ananiases and your Caiaphases and your Herods. And these are the ones that form examples also. Bad examples. Examples to avoid. The Bible, also being a big book, is full of people we don't know much about. Little drop-in characters. Ones we don't have enough information to know if they're good or bad. But then you meet people like Esau. People like Lot. And they're such a mixture of black and white. Now, they're sort of like all of us. They're not so easy to categorize. And we're going to be looking at these two especially, Esau first and Lot briefly. If I were to ask you to choose one adjective to summarize your concept of Esau, what adjective would you choose? One adjective to summarize what Esau creates in your mind. What kind of feeling do you get?
Lazy.
Lazy. Okay. Well, that's an interesting adjective we might use. Anybody got a different suggestion?
Unbelieving.
I think we're going to find that one being a very primary one to look at his life. I guess I would have chosen greedy, maybe unappreciative, perhaps selfish. When we look at Esau, probably the things that come to our mind is that incident where he sold his birthright for a mess of pottage. Or maybe we think of the incident where after his father passed on the blessing to Jacob through that little deception, how Esau begged with crying and tears, "Don't you have a blessing for me also?" Maybe we remember right after that where Esau said, "As long as my father Isaac is alive, okay. But when Isaac dies, I'm going to kill him." Maybe these are the images that we have of Esau. These are scriptural images. These are part of the Esau story. But today we're going to look at three other incidents in Esau's life where all of a sudden Esau is in the reverse role. We're going to look at the incident where Esau meets Jacob upon Jacob's return with his children and wives from Haran, the country where he had gone to find a wife. We're going to look at Esau's choice for his third wife. And we're going to look at Esau's move to Mount Seir, where he spends most of his life and the balance of his days. The first of our incidences, the meeting between Esau and Jacob, is a rather long narrative beginning in the 32nd chapter of Genesis. It happens at a place that is called, even today, Mahanaim. And the name of this place comes from this incident. It's given in the first two verses. Genesis 32, 1 and 2. And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. Now, literally, Mahanaim means the place of two camps. So far, we've only seen one camp. But we'll notice more as we see the preparation that is made for this visit, this historic meeting between these two. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother, unto the land of Seir, the country of Edom, and he commanded them, saying, Thus shall ye speak unto my lord Esau. Thy servant Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban, and stayed there until now, and I have oxen and asses and flocks and men servants and women servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I might find grace in thy sight. And the angels returned to Jacob, saying, We came to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee. So far, so good. And 400 men with him. That's when Jacob began thinking, what's going on? Why doesn't he come alone? I didn't send for 400 men, I sent for Esau. And he's coming and he's bringing 400 men. So Jacob was greatly afraid. He thought it was an army. He thought they were coming to attack. Esau was ready to carry out that threat. When he comes back, I'll kill him. This was the impression in the mind of Jacob. And so he divided the people that were with him, and the flocks, and the herds, and the camels, into Mahanaim, two bands, two camps. And he said, If Esau come to the one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape. The first reaction of Jacob to the return of Esau, to meet him, is strategic. I'm afraid there's a battle coming up. I want to be sure that some of us escape, so I divide into two camps. Then if he attacks one, the other can flee. He had no thought of staying and fighting. He was just worried that he didn't get wiped out in the incident. Then he takes a second line of approach in defense. He prays. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, the Lord which said unto me, Return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of the least of all thy mercies, and of all the truth which thou hast showed to thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And thou sayest, I will surely do thee good, and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Fear again. He's praying. He said, I've separated my people into two camps. You promise you protect me. But right now I need that promise because he's coming. He's got an army. He's got 400 men and they're coming against me. Now, Lord, I know I'm not worthy because I stayed to get the promise. And then when I got the promise, I went across Jordan. I left the promise. As soon as I got it, I fled. I didn't claim that promise then. And so I know I'm not worthy of it. But now that I'm returning, you said when I came back, you would be with me. And he lays it upon God's shoulders. That's his second line of approach. And he lodged there that same night. And he took of that which came to his hand a present for Esau his brother. 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, and 30 milk camels with their colts, 40 kine and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 foals. That's no small present. 610 animals. He takes 610 animals from his flock. He delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by themselves, and he said unto his servants, Pass over before me, and put a space between drove and drove. In other words, pad the present. Make it look bigger. You put so many here, then you leave a space and put so many here, and it looks like a much bigger present than just the 610 that it is. Make it an impressive present. Give him a present that maybe now he will take off from fighting me. And he won't kill me when he returns. So Jacob takes every precaution. Then at about this stage, we find a parenthesis. We find he's now ready, he's done all he can, so he's ready to settle down for the night, and then you have the balance of the chapter deals with the story of the angel and the wrestling with the angel, where he finally gets his blessing and his name changed from Jacob to Israel. Many think of this as the conversion of Jacob, as the incident where Jacob takes on a whole different attitude. So we have to go to the 33rd chapter to find the outcome. So far, we've seen Esau coming with a troop of 400, and we see Jacob having taken three precautions. He divided his people, so in case one was attacked, the other could escape.
he's prayed to the Lord and said, I'm claiming your help. And he's offered a big peace offering of some 600 animals to his brother to settle peace. 33rd chapter. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. And he divided the children unto Leah, and unto Rachel, and unto the two handmaids. And he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after. Rachel and Joseph, the ones he loved the most, he put in the back. And he passed over before them, and he bowed down 7 times to his brother. Did obeisance to his brother. 7 times to the ground until he came near to his brother. Now the battle. And Esau ran and put his arm around his neck and he kissed him and he wept. There was no problem. Esau hadn't gotten 400 men to attack. Esau was arranging a welcoming party. But Jacob was afraid. Jacob was the one who had fears. Esau, in this story, is the noble, forgiving brother. Esau, in this story, is the one who's got his arms open. And Jacob, in this story, is the coward, the fearful one, the one who does not have the faith to move on and is very timid in his approach. In this instance, as opposed to the other instances that we automatically think of, we have a reversal of the roles. You know, it makes me think of another incident, another life entirely, in the life of David. Once David had gotten so depressed and discouraged over all of the constant hunting by Saul for him and for his life, that he finally fled the country. And he went to a little place called Gath. The king of Gath, or the Abimelech of Gath, was a man by the name of Achish. And he asked for political asylum. This story is given in 1 Samuel 21st chapter. And when he gets into Gath, and the king has given him political asylum, has guaranteed him that you're safe, he begins hearing rumors. The nobles of Gath said, who is this guy? This is David. That's the one they sing about when they say, Saul has killed his thousands and David has tens of thousands. He's a spy, he's a spy. And this rumor began to quote, and David heard the rumor. You can believe what happened to David. He got scared. He's like, I got to get out of this place. And he didn't dare go and just, he didn't feel he dared go to the king and say he's heard this rumor. That was taking too much of a chance. So he decided to do something, play a little trick that would get him out safely. And all of a sudden he pretended like he went mad. So he went to the gate and he scrabbled like a dog and drooled out of the mouth. And the king said, well, I have you, a madman, get rid of him. And David escaped. Well, as David was fleeing, David wrote a psalm. He wrote a psalm about his feelings in his heart over that incident. It's the 34th psalm. And you know it's over that incident because the title tells you so. The title gives you the background for the writing of the psalm. Now, this is the psalm, by the way. This title is a psalm of David when he changed his behavior before Abimelech, who drove him away, he departed. This is the psalm that David says, keep my lips from speaking guile. He had just done a masterful job of it. He had done enough guile speaking to get out of the town. And now he's sorry for it. He says, Lord, keep me from doing that again. But it's this psalm in verse 4. It's this incident that David records these words. I sought the Lord and he heard me, and he delivered me from all my fears. He did not choose the word dangers because there weren't any. Achish had given his assurance. And David, now that he's escaped, realizes that I was a captive of my fears. It was his fears that held him back. And it was his fears that he is now saying, Lord, you deliver me from even that. So often with us, isn't it the same? The greatest things we face in life are not real dangers. The big problems out there are not what's going to happen. It's what we are afraid might happen. This could happen. It could. Probably won't, but it could. And we dwell on what might happen until it fills our mind, and we have one thought, how to escape from that fear. And the antidote is, it's so simple. So hard to apply, but so simple. 1 Peter 5:7. Cast all your cares upon him, for he careth for you. I think we've all realized that in that verse, the word care And the two times it's used is from different words. The first time it means cast all your anxieties upon him. And the second time it means to give forethought. For he has already given forethought to your problems. That's what David had to come to realize. That's what Jacob should have realized. That's what we need to come to realize. But that's an afterthought. We're talking about Esau. We've seen in this one incident now where it's Esau the noble. Jacob showing less than nobility. Now we want to look at Esau's wives. He had three of them. The first two of his wives are recorded in Genesis chapter 26, verses 34 and 35. And they were pretty poor choices. Esau was 40 years old when he took to him Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and Rebekah. He married Canaanites or Hittites, those from the land, and evidently there was enough of the local idolatrous custom that it was just a grief of mind. But now, Esau also has experiences, like you and I. And one of his experiences was losing that blessing and seeing his brother get it. And not only does he see his brother get the blessing, but Esau overhears. Esau overhears Rebekah and Isaac sending him away to Haran. And he overhears a commission they were given. Do not marry anybody from this land, but marry from our people back in Haran. And Esau's listening. He's mad. He wants to kill his brother. But he's listening. And he marries then his third wife. And this is recorded in Genesis chapter 28, verses 6 to 9. When Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take him a wife from thence, and that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge, saying, Thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan, and that Jacob obeyed his father and his mother, and was gone to Padan Aram. And Esau, seeing that the daughters of Canaan pleased not Isaac his father, then went Esau unto Ishmael, and took unto the wives which he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the daughter of Nebajoth, to be his wife. Notice, he was angry enough to kill his brother, but he was also listening. He didn't listen good enough to go all the way back to Haran, but he listened enough to know, I have been a fool. I should not have taken the wives of this land. It will please my parents if I take a wife of a nearer kinfolk. And he goes to a nearer kinfolk, a different kinfolk, but a nearer one, to Ishmael, also the son of Abraham. And he chooses a wife from there. You have then Esau, who becomes converted from the threatening avenger in the first story to being the forgiving brother in the second. And now you find Esau, who had been the rebellious child seeking who he wanted to marry, all of a sudden learning a lesson and choosing someone that he thought would be acceptable to his parents, a much more considerate child, a growth in Esau. Now we want to look at the third of the three experiences of Esau, and that's his move to Mount Seir. Before we do that, we'd like to treat just a little sidelight, and that is the structure of the book of Genesis. You know, Genesis, like the others of the first five books, were written by Moses. But unlike Exodus through Deuteronomy, Genesis could not be written from personal experience. Because Genesis was historical. It related to things that happened before Moses was alive to know. So how did Moses know? Well, perhaps some of it he knew through verbal tradition. Certainly you've seen these charts that show the few places that you have to go from all the way from Adam to Moses. But there's other indication that basically there were written records. There were written records that were there and accumulated in a phrase you will find over and over in Genesis, 11 times, is the phrase, the book of the generations of. And most expositors feel that that phrase means, here starts a new series of clay tablets. And these were a book, accumulation of writings, that recorded this section of the history. And what Moses did was accumulate these. And all of Genesis, from chapter 2, verse 4, on to the end, is composed of these books. Of the generations of. The first chapter either being by special revelation of God to Moses or by tradition passed down. In chapter 5, verse 1, you got the book of the generations of Adam. In chapter 6, verse 9, you got the book of the generations of Noah. Chapter 37, verse 2, you got the book of the generations of Jacob. And there's one for Joseph and for Noah and for the heavens and the earth even. All these books of generation. But one person, and only one person, was important enough to have two books named after him. Because there's one book of the generations of Abraham, and there's only one book of the generations of Joseph. Would you believe there are two books of the generations of Esau? He's the only one you got, first and second Esau. And they're both in the same chapter of the Bible. They're both in chapter 37 of Genesis. Chapter 36. Chapter 36, 1 says, now these are the generations of Esau who was Edom. 36, 9 says, and these are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites, in Mount Seir. Notice the difference. The first is the generations of Esau until he gets to Mount Seir. And the second is the generations of Esau after he gets to Mount Seir. The move to Mount Seir is such a turning point, it warrants a whole new book of history to be written about it. The first book being very small. Now there are two questions we want to examine together. The first question is, why? Why did Esau move to Mount Seir? We don't need to guess. The Bible is explicit. Genesis 36 and 1 Esau. 1 Esau, the sixth verse. And Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all the persons of his house and his cattle and all his beasts and all his substance, which he had got in the land of Canaan, and he went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob, because their riches were more than that they could dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. They had more possessions than the land could bear. One had to give. Esau gave. Esau cedes the land to his brother, and he moves. Very similar to Abraham and Lot. Different, but similar. They also separated because of the amount of their products and their flocks. Here is the reason for separation. But now our second question, and the important question. When did Esau move to Mount Seir? If you go back with me to the 32nd chapter, to our original story, there's something we'd like to notice at the very beginning of that story. Genesis 32:3. Remember, this is when Jacob is first returning. He's coming back from his brother, from where he married his wives, from Padan Aram. And on his way back, he seeks this meeting with his brother. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother. Where? Into the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Esau had already moved to Seir before the return of Jacob. He had moved there long enough for the country to have its name changed to the land of Edom before the return of Jacob. But the reason for the move was because the land wouldn't bear them all. But they weren't all there. Jacob hadn't even returned. Notice the implication. The implication is that Esau knew that Jacob was coming back. There had to be some kind of information passed to him. Esau had to know that Jacob had already achieved large flocks and herds. Esau had already had to consider the fact the land wasn't big enough for both of them. And Esau has to make a decision, and his decision is voluntarily to leave the land so his brother can have it. That's a different Esau than we met when he begged the blessing. That's a different Esau than when he comes back, I'll kill him. This is an Esau now who, even in anticipation of his brother's return, leaves. There is a nobility in this case. He accepted the loss of both the birthright and the blessing. Esau was a man of growth in this story. Let's go back to our original question. How do we term Esau? Well, we've had lazy. I had unappreciative. I had greedy. I was going to put in there ambitious, too, for a while. But that wouldn't work well with lazy, so I'll leave that one out. It don't fit so well anymore. when we look at the whole of Esau.
The Apostle Paul looked at Esau, and he chose an adjective. And his adjective was neither of the ones we chose. Let's look at Paul's adjective. You're going to study it next week anyway.
Hebrews, the 12th chapter. That's what you're going to study, so you should be getting into that. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 16. And let's notice Paul's definition of Esau. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. Paul's adjective is profane. Well, you know, that's an odd word. We don't really use the word profane a whole lot anymore. We use a similar word. We use the word profanity. I guess when we think of profanity, we think of pretty bad stuff, vulgar language, things that we shouldn't be saying. And so we think of profane as a pretty bad word, too. Profane must mean a very wicked thing, because profanity is pretty wicked. But that's not what profane means. The word profane is taken from the Latin. The word pro, meaning outside of, and fanum, meaning the temple. Outside of the temple. Secular. Has no relation whatever to a moral quality. Paul is making absolutely no moral judgment upon Esau. He's just stating historical fact. Esau was non-religious. That's all he's saying. He was outside of the temple. He was not temple-type person. He could have been a very noble person. In fact, he was very noble. But he was outside of the temple. Religion was not his thing. He wasn't spiritually minded. He was a naturally minded person. And that's what Paul's stating. He's not stating anything derogatory. He's only stating historical fact. Here was a man. I don't want you to be like him. I want you to be religious. He was non-religious. That's all he's saying. When you think of that, think about the other word we use, the word profanity. There's a lot more profanities than vulgar language. There's a lot of other words that should not be used in the temple. Rumors. It's profanity. It's not temple language. Repetition of stories is not temple language. That's profanity outside of the temple. Gossip. That's profanity. That's words that belong outside of the temple. Frivolity and idle chit-chat. Frivolity is profanity. It's words that don't belong in a temple setting. And if we classify them all together, all of a sudden, we've got to watch our lip twice as hard. Because these are things that hit us a lot more than our tendency to use a swear word. I don't see many of you doing that. But I do sometimes hear the other kinds of profanity. And these are equally profane and not belonging. Let's going back to Paul. Paul's evaluation of Esau does not touch at all his moral standard. It is purely an objective evaluation of the facts. Here was a man who was not interested in religious things, a secular, a materialist. He was not saying he was immoral. He was not saying that Esau was a sinner. And he was not saying that Esau was wicked. And I found this personally a very important lesson, because I found that my own judgment of Esau tended to be very negative, that I tended to think of Esau as a very bad person. And I began to realize that what was true with me is true of others as well. We are prone to judge as evil what may be only weakness. We are prone to hit as wicked what may be nothing more than just a lack of a tendency toward the same religious thing. And Pastor Russell puts it beautifully. He says, to judge another for what he cannot see is like judging a blind man for what he cannot see. You don't pity a blind man because he cannot see the chair that you can see. I mean, you don't judge him. You pity him. And so it is when we see others doing things that we may say are Esau-like. These are not matters for judgment. These are matters for pity. These are matters for patience, to patiently work with. Weakness is always to be dealt with patience. Evilness is to be condemned and punished. And we must be careful that when we look at Esau's, that we look at the whole
person, and not only his Mesa Pottage incident, that may have bought it as copybook. But let's see if he's learned. Let's see if there's progress. Let's see if there's growth. Let's see if there's something we can look back and say, he is a noble person, even though we may say he's not a religious person. Another adjective from you, please. What adjective would you use with Lot? And change persons now. Give me an adjective that sums up Lot in your mind. I thought there'd be a lot of adjectives. Who can give me one for Lot? Opportunist. That's pretty close to mine. I like you, Teresa. You think I think alike. Okay. Anyone else? Any other adjective for Lot? I'm going to give you one from the Bible. An apostle's evaluation of Lot. It's found in Peter, 2 Peter, the second chapter, verses 7 and 8. And let's see if he chose opportunist. And delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man, dwelling among them and seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. Would you really have picked righteous? I certainly wouldn't have. But that's what the apostle picks. The apostle picked the adjective just and righteous for Lot. And not opportunist, or mine was selfish. Very similar. Again, it's because we look at part of Lot. We look at the Lot who chose the plains of Sodom. We look at the Lot who needed to be pulled by the hand out of that city. Or maybe we look at the Lot of that sordid little incident where he lays with his own daughters to produce the seed afterwards in a drunken stupor. And we say, that's not a Lot that appeals to me. And yet Peter, who knew that, still calls him just and righteous. Who is this Lot? Well, Genesis 11:27 tells us that he is the son of Haran, Abraham's brother. Let's go back to Genesis a little bit here and just get a clear identification of who Lot is. Now, these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran begat Lot. So now we know who his father was. Father was Haran, Abram's brother. Lot had two sisters, 29th verse. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. So Lot had two sisters, Iscah and Milcah. And that's your family. His parent was Haran, and his two sisters were Milcah and Iscah. Jewish tradition and Josephus say that Iscah we would know better by the name of Sarai. They identify Iscah with Sarai, and that Abram marries actually Lot's sister. Now, there is some reason to question that, because Abram, in Genesis 20, identifies Sarai as his half-sister, be that as it may. Nahor, Abram's brother, marries Milcah, Haran's son. So you got possibly two uncles marrying two nieces. It's a family situation. It's a very close-knit problem. In any case, the closest relative after Nahor's death that Lot has upon this earth is Milcah, his oldest sister. That's his closest living relative. I just want to keep that fact in our mind. Because now I want to move to another thing. Abram. When we think of Abram, probably the first incident we think of, and correctly so, is Abram's move out of Ur of the Chaldees to Haran, and eventually out of Haran to the Promised Land. Paul in Hebrews 11:8 singles this out as an act of faith. One of the outstanding acts of faith. By faith, Abram left Haran and went to a land that he knew not. Well, what about Lot? Wasn't there any faith in Lot's part? Lot didn't have to go. His closest relative didn't go. His older sister stayed. Lot made a decision not to stay with his closest relative, but to also go. Lot also exercises faith, and therefore is given the title of a man of faith, a man of righteousness. But after he gets there, problems develop.
And a separation comes between Abram and Lot, and Lot goes to the plains of Sodom. The reason was identical with the reason of Esau and Jacob. The land wasn't big enough. Now, we often think of what a bad choice he made. We don't often think of the fact that if he had chosen the other, then Abram would have gone to Sodom. That doesn't cross our mind, because there are the two choices open. But in any case, a bad choice was made. But then we often think, now here is where Lot goes from righteousness to unrighteousness. Here is the point of turnaround. As though all of a sudden he become bad Lot. Peter doesn't say that. Peter still calls him righteous Lot. Actually, as you read the account carefully, there is a decline in Lot's faith. There's no question that Lot's faith declines as he takes a step, but not instantly, not overnight. If you read it carefully, you'll find seven steps of decline. It isn't quick. The first step is Genesis 13:7. Strife. Strife between Abram's herdsmen and Lot's herdsmen. Not even strife between Abram and Lot. Between their herdsmen. Not being able to settle the strife, they come to a point of division. The strife, if the strife had never happened, the division had never happened. If the division had never happened, there never would have been Lot and Sodom. So the strife is the first point. Letting strife bring about the actual division that took place. The second step, Genesis 13:10. Lot beheld, and the word means to behold with desire. He desired the richer land. That's not a sin in itself. We can look and we see things, and I'd like to have that. That's all that says. That's the second step. The third, in the next verse, he chose that which he beheld. That's where you get into problems. You can behold and say, well, it's nice, but it's not the best. And there are things that are more important. The choosing was the third problem. But don't think that when he chose, he immediately chose to go to Sodom. It doesn't say that. It says he dwelt toward Sodom. His inclination was toward Sodom. Verse 12. He does not immediately move into the city of Sodom. He's not a city dweller. He's a man with flocks and herds. He's a countryman. He's out there to graze his cattle. But he goes in the direction of Sodom. It's not to the fifth step, the 14th chapter, verse 12, that he moves into Sodom. He's been by, now he moves into. That's the fifth step of deterioration. The sixth step, being in Sodom, he assimilates with Sodom by letting his daughters marry their husbands. And now he integrates into the city and becomes a Sodomite, as opposed to a resident in Sodom. But his final step, in 19th chapter, the first verse, he eventually rises to prominence in Sodom and sits in the gate as a judge of Sodom. He now has gone all the way from his position way outside of Sodom, step by step, each step taking closer, until he becomes a judge in Sodom. Now, after he moves to Sodom, he gets into trouble twice. The first incident is the 14th chapter of Genesis. In this incident, the battle of the five kings against four, he's taken captive. And God, through Abram, saves Lot by saving Sodom. He saves the whole city for Lot's sake. And all the booty into the hands of the king of Sodom. Everything is returned to Sodom. In the next incident, in the 19th chapter, God again saves Lot by destroying Sodom. Just the opposite method. The first time he saves Lot by saving the whole city, the second time he saves Lot by destroying the city. Why the two different methods of salvation? Because there's a progress in development. The first time it was the warning. You have made a mistake. Your dwelling in Sodom is going to cause this problem of being taken captive and having problems in the area. But Lot, not heeding the warning, finally had to be pulled, like it says in Zechariah, a brand plucked out of the burning and saved through the fire. So the record is quite clear. Lot's a failure. You can't get around it. He goes into Sodom, and regardless of the fact that it's not instantaneous, he backslides until he's a failure. But 2 Peter still sits there. Just Lot. That righteous man with a righteous soul, he vexed his righteous soul. Let's go back to that, Peter. Notice that again. It
2 Peter, the second chapter, 7 and 8. Let's tell me, I want to call your attention to the word vexed. And delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them in seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. The word vexed in these two texts are two different words. It is not the same word, and it's not the same thought. You can even notice it the way it reads in the King James. In the first case, he was vexed by the filthy conversation of the wicked. It was passive. He was there, and the vexing took place upon him. In the second case, he is doing the vexing. He vexes his righteous soul. It's now an active thing he does. The word in the first case means to be depressed. Lot was depressed by the constant irreverence, the constant sinfulness of the city that he was dwelling in. But the second word means to put to the test. He put himself to the test as to what his reaction would be, seeing this around him. And the evidence is, he sought to control it by becoming a reform judge. Not rising politically, but rising from the standpoint of trying to reform a bad city. And therefore, he was a righteous man in doing this, albeit a failure. It didn't overrule the fact that he was a failure, but he strove to reform and to correct. And in this, he was still wrong. Because the parable of Jesus in Matthew 9, 16, and 17 is you just cannot take an old wineskin and put in new wine. You just can't reform it. You can't take an old garment and put on new patches. But that was, Lot didn't hear those parables. That was after his time. But that was the lesson he was to learn. So Peter's judgment is, even though he falls to these temptations, he is still just and righteous. He is not bad. He's weak. Again, it's the same lesson. We should not judge as bad that which is only weakness. This is too much of a tendency. There are two stories with two different lessons in them. One lesson in both stories is a lesson for our own conduct. The other lesson is a lesson for our judgment of another in their conduct. Esau and Lot's problems were different, but they were related. They were both materialistic. And materialism is something to be avoided. Materialism will drag down the individual. In the case of Esau, it was a worldly man without any spiritual interest, doing the natural thing for a worldly man, progressing materially. In Lot's case, it was a backsliding man of faith, but retaining his righteousness. The lesson in both cases is the same. Avoid materialism. But the second lesson, and perhaps the more important, is how we judge another. Neither Esau nor Lot do the apostles judge as wicked, but both as weak. And we likewise, in our judgment of others, must never judge as weakness. Was never judged as evil, that which is only weakness. We must never condemn that which needs to be pitied and worked with. We must never cast out that which needs to be cultivated and improved. We must never amputate where healing is the remedy that is to be sought. Brother Russell has treated this very beautifully in a reprint article on page 5884 called The Principles of Love and Justice Contrasted. And I'm going to close with just one quotation from this article. If justice must mark our conduct toward others, so love must be used by us in measuring the conduct of others toward us. We may not apply to others the strict rules of justice which we acknowledge as our responsibility to them. Love, generosity, demands that we accept from others less than justice, because we realize that they are fallen, imperfect, not only in their flesh, but also in their judgments. Furthermore, we see that the great mass of the world has not received the Spirit of the Lord at all, and therefore they cannot appreciate these basic principles of justice and love as we appreciate them. We must, in love, look sympathetically upon their condition, as we would look upon the condition of a sick neighbor, friend, parent, or child. We must make allowances for their disordered condition and think as charitably as possible of their words and conduct. And I suggest, as you go to that article and read it, put in there Esau, put in there Lot, and then put in there the names of brethren and sisters that maybe you have been prone to judge, and see how these principles operate so beautifully. For myself, it was a revelation to notice this, the beauties in the character of these two, to see the fuller story of their lives, and hopefully it has been to each of us. May the Lord bless us all.
We appreciate that very interesting and informative lesson on these two biblical characters.
Our Heavenly Father, we do need to be sent over and over to the blood of our Master. We know it is through Him alone that we can be kept whole. Help us, Father, to have an ever realization of our needs and shortcomings. Help us to always turn to Thee, to look to Thee for correction and guidance. Bless our continued fellowship that we have as we begin to part. Guide and direct each life, Father, as each one strives to interpret Your will and to live in harmony therewith. To that end, we leave ourselves in Thy care, in the name of Jesus our Lord. Amen.